Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Douglas Teich from Brookline, Massachusetts, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and thank you to Douglas from Brookline, Massachusetts, where we've been speculating that there may or may not be a notable golf course. We certainly think that there is a golf course in a place called Brookline. So Douglas, if that's where you live, I hope it's lovely. And thank you very much for your support of the podcast and your intro there. This is a podcast being recorded on Monday, the 22nd of March. The Miami Open starts this week. The first ATP and WTA combined 1,000 event, well, ever since the WTA switched up their tournament naming system to become a 1,500-250 situation that mirrors that of the ATP. It's a podcast recording that has been slightly delayed by my collecting a new pair of glasses.
Very nice.
We've been on this Zoom call for about 20 minutes and nobody's mentioned them, and I'm worried that they look crap.
No, they're lovely, aren't they, Matt?
I hate to fish for compliments, but
I only didn't mention them because we talked about them earlier in such detail on WhatsApp.
Okay, but now you're seeing them in live, living colour. They're moving.
And they are just as great as I thought they were.
They've lived up to all expectations, and they will look magnificent on the telly when you start.
Great. Thank you. Yes, coverage of the Miami Open starts on Prime Video on Wednesday.
Can you remember how to do it?
Yes.
Excellent.
Well, we'll tune in on Wednesday to find out if you're in the UK and Ireland. And also if you want to check out my new pair of glasses. I've been chatting to Andy Murray this week. I mentioned that on the last pod, but I can now talk about what he said in that interview. We'll be coming onto that later on after we've talked about what's happened in the last 4 or 5 days of tennis. And we possibly, David and Matt, went a bit early with our Aslan Karatsev is definitely a thing podcast. Can we just chop out our big Aslan Karatsev in the kitchen discussion and plonk it back into this week's podcast?
What has he moved on in his kitchen status? That's the question. Because, I mean,
what, dancing on the table?
I don't know. We haven't really worked out the key.
Coyote Ugly style.
We haven't really worked out the levels yet, but Jannik Sinner has given us the base, obviously, and now we're working on the detail of what goes in the kitchen and who's what, who's in charge of what. But yeah, he is one of those players who keeps surprising, and I'm waiting for him to run into a brick wall where it doesn't happen for him, because at the moment he seems to have answers for everything. And he's gone on from that wonderful run at the Australian Open and just reproduced it on a major tour stop to come through all comers. And I love what he's doing. I mean, the match against Andrei Rublev the other day was a real shock to the system, because he did to Rublev what the very top players do to Rublev at Grand Slams. He stood there and he said, come on, give me your best shots. And he hit them back with interest, and to the point where he hit double the amount of winners as his opponent. Incredible, really. And he just seems to... Pace doesn't bother him at all. If you come at him with pace, he's going to take you on and he's going to knock you out, clean out. And I find it really interesting to see where that leads him.
That was a real benchmark result, I think, beating Rublev in the semi-finals, because what we always say about Rublev is he beats everybody that he's supposed to beat, and he loses to the people that are just a bit better than him. So is Aslan Karatsev just a bit better than even Andrei Rublev, who, okay, he's the world number 8 at the moment. He thinks he should be the world number 4. That is a topic of discussion we'll be coming on to later. But I think in terms of the race, oh, that was dreadful. That was a dreadful. I would ask you to edit it out, but I know you won't.
That was meant to be Rafael Nadal, wasn't it?
Oh, sort of. I didn't plan it. It was dreadful. Anyway, the race. In terms of the race, he would be, I think world number 4, Andrei Rublev. So is Aslan Karatsev better than Andrei Rublev at the moment? Is it as simple as that? Is he a sort of top 5 tennis player at the moment?
At the moment, yes. I think he's shown a peak level, which is absolutely among the top 5 that we've seen this year. I think he's 5 in the race himself, Karatsev. I've seen Rublev's game look ineffective. I'm not sure I've ever seen him bullied in the way that Karatsev was just manhandling him. It was very similar to what he did to Schwartzman at the Australian Open. You just saw two players, and if you came to that match completely blind, you would have thought that Karatsev was the one with the higher ceiling, the higher ranking, the more potential. It was just one dodgy game he played in the second set that actually made the match close, and Rublev managed to win the second set. But otherwise, it was a real sort of drubbing that Karatsev handed out. He's got incredible power off both wings, these compact swings, which he seems to be able to hit either down the line or cross court at will. He's putting up the most incredible numbers on return. His returning stats this year are at the absolute top level. And yeah, I think, when is this going to end? That's kind of the feeling I'm left with. But maybe it isn't. Maybe this is now his level and a level that he's comfortable at. I think he's going to Miami without his coach, because his coach couldn't get a visa. So that would be kind of interesting to see sort of how he copes at a Masters 1000 event and everything that comes with that for the first time. But yeah, I mean, the secret's out. I think we can say that about Karatsev. Medvedev described him as the secret weapon. This is now a known quantity, and players are not going to want to face him. Just a weapon now, yeah.
He's just a straight-up weapon.
He's only lost to Djokovic and team this year. Everyone else he's beaten.
I do love the way he's just sort of catapulted him into the conversation after a few weeks of being better than Rublev. It's like when my son says to me, "Well, Albion, our West Bromwich Albion, we beat Sheffield United, who beat Liverpool. So we're better than Liverpool, Dad, aren't we?"
That is definitely how sport works.
And I just go, yeah, that's about the size of it, son, yeah.
Oh, I love that.
I mean, Rublev's thing has been consistency over a long period of time, and there's a lot to be said for that. That gets you in the top 10 of the rankings if you can consistently win a lot of tournaments and a lot of matches. You know, we've speculated, what is Rublev's ceiling? And it's possible that someone like Karatsev can come along and be able to play better tennis in a one-off match, in a one-off tournament. He might not have the consistency, but he's going to potentially have higher peaks. I don't know. I mean, he's certainly in the kitchen. Is he in the mix for Miami?
Oh, crikey. Well, the mix in Miami for the ATP tournament is a mess, really. Is there anybody in that draw that's not in the mix? It's going to be such a weird draw. I mean, to be clear, the list of withdrawals, and there are some notable ones on the women's side. We had Serena Williams withdrawing a couple of days ago after oral surgery. She says she's really gutted to be missing the tournament. She considers it her home tournament. She's really disappointed to miss out, she says. But the men's side is decimated, and we might not yet be at the full list of withdrawals. We'll come on to talk about it some more because various players have been making various comments about something that might be brewing in tennis. We will settle on that and discuss it. But just to stick on the tennis and the mix, which Matt has suddenly thrown into the conversation, for the men, the Miami Open is a heck of an opportunity to win a Masters 1000 title for someone, whether it be someone that's coming back, someone that's trying to establish themselves, someone that's trying to raise their ceiling and push on to the next kind of milestone. It's a huge gaping opportunity, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and a guy like Karatsev, a lot will depend, I would have thought, on how he transitions with this trip from Dubai, because that can't be that easy to just make that trip, get accustomed to it when everybody else has already been over there maybe for a while longer. But at least it is a two-week tournament, or at least a week and a half tournament, so you have a bit longer to get into it. And he just seems very comfortable at this level. That's the thing that really surprises me, is that that wasn't a two-week spell showing a one-off. I mean, I still don't fully get it, if I'm honest, when I look at his age and his list of, well, his career trajectory to this point. I listened to his press conference after the title win in Dubai, and he was asked about that. You came along and you had 2013 to 2018, and your ranking was down in the hundreds and lower. And he described his journey from trying to find the right place to base himself. And he spent time in Germany, and then he spent time in Barcelona for 3 years. And he said it, in the end, it was a coach that really made the difference to me, just finding the right coach. And he said it wasn't about it being a big named coach or anything like that. It was just the right coach for me, who settled on how I should play and how we should work. And I've got to this point. And obviously he's been catapulted up by that Australian Open performance. But seeing what he's capable of, it is his timing, his ability with the racket. It is incredible that it didn't happen earlier for him. But now his level looks like it belongs. And you're right. It's an opportunity for him in Miami. It's an opportunity for him everywhere, because his game should do all right on clay, I would have thought. I mean, what a ball striker.
Mm. It's interesting. I've tried to find footage of previous Aslan Karatsev. Sort of pre-lockdown Aslan Karatsev, pre-being really good Aslan Karatsev, and there is so little available because he was playing so few televised tournaments, and what is available is on really ropey cameras, really dodgy angles and sort of smudgy lenses and so on. So it's not quite as satisfying and binary a transformation as, say, Jennifer Brady, where it's that really clear story arc for her. I had this moment, this is how it would be told in a film about Jennifer Brady's life. I had this light bulb moment where I decided I'm not making the most of my career. I've got to do something different. I'm going to move to Germany. I'm going to make myself as strong physically as I possibly can, get this new coach that completely puts me through my paces, and I've got a whole new outlook on the sport. It's not quite that story for Karatsev, is it? It's more, it's less easy to tell in a Hollywood movie type thing. It would be more of an art house thing with fewer cliches.
It feels like it begins at the Australian Open, because although he had that series of really good challenger results last year, the manner in which he rocked up in Melbourne and went through qualifying and just blazed his way through the draw, it's Rocky Balboa stuff, really. And like you say, I don't feel like I understand.
That's not an art house movie, David. You've just blown my analogy apart.
I bloody love Rocky Balboa. Anyway, I just feel that I don't know what the guy's story is, really. I mean, he's an interesting fella to listen to.
I think it's 27 years of doing calf exercises in the gym
for this moment,
for it's all coming to fruition in 2021.
His legs touch each other as he walks.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I swear they're getting bigger,
like cartoon characters.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he's number five in the race. He's languishing way, way lower in the rankings because it's so, so hard to climb up. Zverev and Rublev have both had pops at the ranking system this week. Zverev said he thinks it's absurd that he remained behind Roger Federer in the rankings. That was a comment we picked up on last week. And those comments were put to Rublev. And he said, if we would have the normal system, I would be like number four in the world, I think. So what do you think is better for me, to be number eight or number four? I mean, sure, there are, you know, the current system will disadvantage certain individuals, and tennis is a selfish sport. I would expect those individuals to be unhappy about it, but that doesn't mean in the overall that this isn't still making the best of a bad situation. I'm still yet to hear a proposed alternative which is superior to what we have, as unsatisfactory as it as what we have might sometimes feel. So you'll just have to settle for being in the kitchen for now, even if it's not reflected in the rankings. They're both in the kitchen, just sort of making an omelette, I would say.
We're going to have to, periodically, we're going to have to just retell what Yannick Sinner has said to set us up with the kitchen analogy in the first place.
Yes. Well, you know in MasterChef where someone sort of makes a shepherd's pie and they sort of waftedly say, it's me on a plate. Do you ever sort of think about what you would describe as you on a plate? I often think it's an omelette. I often have fantasies about going on MasterChef, making a cheese omelette and going, it's just me on a plate. What would be Aslan Karatsev on a plate?
And honestly, say, I've never given that any thought ever.
You're going to now, though. Does it not make you laugh when people like cook a steak and chips and it's just me on a plate?
Aslan would be a rump steak.
Yes. Mm. But cows have quite spindly legs.
Do they? Right.
Mm, relative to their body size. I don't know what animal does have big calves. I've driven us all down a cul-de-sac here. Matt, have you got anything to contribute to this very stretched analogy?
No.
No, no, right. Okay. So it was, we should probably mention the man he beat in the final in Dubai, Lloyd Harris. Who's been on a heck of a run of late, Lloyd Harris, sort of snuck up on us all and is somebody that's making the most of his opportunity. Again, we mentioned him briefly in last week's podcast. We touched upon him. I've watched a bit more of him since then, in particular his win over Denis Shapovalov in the semi-finals, which was, I think, as much about Denis Shapovalov squandering a massive opportunity, might even have to use the C word, to describe that loss for Shapovalov. But Lloyd Harris is a better tennis player than I thought he was. And goodness me, what an athlete. Goodness me. That is, I mean, yeah, he is maximising, isn't he? There's a lot more substance to him than I realised.
Covers the court incredibly well. And, I mean, he was hurt in that match a bit as well. He was feeling it. And Shapovalov was playing beautifully, and yes, I mean, he did tighten horribly, including two double faults when he was locked in battle in the second set to give Harris the second set. But to some degree, that movement extracts the choke. He kept on making Shapovalov play, and I feel like I'm slightly letting Dennis off the hook a bit there because he blew it. He really did blow it, but Harris is, yeah, he keeps turning up. I mean, he and Karatsev, not that dissimilar in that way. The fact that nobody talks about them. You know, you come into these events, nobody's looking for Lloyd Harris in the draw, and yet he often makes himself a little bit relevant somehow. So, fair play.
He might end up being sort of third seed in Miami the way we're going. Then we'll be looking for him in the draw.
Shapovalov has won one of his 11 semi-finals on the ATP Tour. I hadn't really registered that he had such a poor record in semi-finals. He's been through to two finals because he got a walkover in one semi-final. But he's been the higher-ranked player in about half of those semi-finals. So it feels like he has a problem, a big problem in those matches. And yeah, he was he a set and 4-2 up on Lloyd Harris?
Mm.
You've got to close
and
that.
The nature of this defeat will surely add to that problem, assuming that problem is a mental one, which the stats would suggest.
And the double
that
faults.
That is a loss that comes with baggage.
When he was trying to find a way to get his serve in effectively at the end of that second set, he was standing way out wide to serve to, well, it's the deuce court, but the one where he's hitting, you know, out wide the other way. And he was standing in the corner like he was a doubles player. And he was almost falling over as he's hitting the serve because he was so off balance because of the way the ball toss was. And it's really disconcerting to watch it. You feel edgy watching him in that situation. And yeah, he's got to find a way to get over that.
Well, he'll be very high seeded we've had the women's draw. We haven't had the men's draw yet in Miami, but he'll certainly be a top 10 seed, I would think, Denis Shapovalov. So big opportunity for him. But as I say, I do worry about that baggage that is accumulating. Juan Sebastian Cabal, Robert Farah won the doubles title in Dubai. They beat Nikola Mektic and Mate Pavic. Mektic and Pavic are a new partnership for this year. There's a lot of those. That's their first title for 18 months, Cabal and Farah, which I hadn't really... I mean, I know it's been a weird 18 months, very interrupted, but I still hadn't really processed that they had gone so long without a title, because there was that period around when they won that Wimbledon title, which I guess was 2019, when they just felt completely invincible for a while and they were just riding this wave and sort of just sweeping everybody aside before them. So first title in 18 months for them. We'll stay with the men, seeing as we're there. We've had a title for Alexander Zverev in Acapulco. He beat Stefanos Tsitsipas in the final. Tsitsipas was the eventual conqueror of Lorenzo Musetti in the semi-finals. I've just watched a 15-minute tennis TV highlights reel of Lorenzo Musetti from all his matches over the week, and I enjoyed it very much indeed.
Yeah, he's cool. Mm. Matt, you saw a lot of him, including that match against Tsitsipas, and I think he was a bit hurt in that one, wasn't he? But I think he probably also hit the wall and hit Tsitsipas in good form. It's almost like how I would imagine Musetti playing himself in 3 years' time. You know?
Yes, I think that's a good description. That Tsitsipas just has a little bit more power, a little more to his game. He's a little more developed than Musetti, and combine that with the way Musetti was feeling physically after a lot of long matches. He had quite a lot of treatment on an ab problem during that match. But he was great to watch. He really was. It felt to me like he was the story in Acapulco.
Mm. And thankfully, he hopefully will continue that story to Miami, because he has got into the draw there.
Yes.
Which is just great news for Miami.
Yes, as the men kept withdrawing from Miami, Musetti was getting closer and closer, and eventually he did get in. This is going to be one of those sentences which annoys both of you, but I can't remember the feeling, because I was too young, of what it was like when Richard Gasquet was coming through. But I feel a little bit like there are potentially some comparisons with Musetti in terms of, I mean, obviously in terms of playing style wise. Mm. And just this, from what I've read and from some things I've heard, I think Gasquet was so exciting when he came through. And there was this idea that, oh, great, we're going to get to watch Gasquet's tennis for the next 10 years at least. And it's expressive tennis and it's going to be a joy to watch. I have that feeling about Musetti at the moment. I think if he can put it together, that game is going to be so thrilling to watch, because it's just so pleasing on the eye, the way he constructs points, the way he hits the tennis ball.
He's more of a showman, I think, than Richard Gasquet ever even promised to be at a young age. He seems like he's going to be comfortable in the spotlight.
Yeah, he enjoys it more, doesn't he?
Yeah, I don't think Richard Gasquet ever looked like he was comfortable with the byproducts of his style of play. There was sort of a clash between the way he played and his personality, whereas with Lorenzo Mazzetti, it seems to be a synergy.
They're in tandem.
I was at Gasquet's professional debut when he was 15 in 2002 in Monte Carlo, and he played. He won his professional debut match against a former French Open semi-finalist, Franco Squillari. And I mean, it was incredible to watch. And I remember Tim Henman, who ended up reaching the semifinals at Monte Carlo, was asked about Gasquet in his post-match press conference. Did you watch any of him? And all he did was motion his backhand like that, and through the air like a shadow stroke, as if to say, yeah, that shot's special. And I do feel, I mean, there have been some stats going around this last week. I think Gasquet won something like his 550th match or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what the number was, but there was a notable number. And yet I feel a bit shortchanged by Richard Gasquet's career when I think of how he made us feel back then. And he backed that up by, I think he beat Federer at Monte Carlo. I'll never forget commentating on him at Wimbledon on court number one, knocking out Andy Roddick in 2007, Roddick coming in as the champion at Queens. And he hit just dozens of backhand winners. I mean, I think there might have been 60 odd backhand winners that day. And he didn't quite, I don't think, fulfill his potential. Mazzetti, looking at him, he really is exciting because he's beefed up. He's got these wonderful strokes, flowing strokes, and he does seem to love the occasion. He seems to lap it up. I mean, I did think when we spoke on Thursday, we were talking about, will we stay up and set the alarm for him against Dimitrov, which was that strange feeling of, this is what Dimitrov used to be 10 years ago. And I watched that, and it was a straight set win for Mazzetti. He was brilliant. He really overpowered Dimitrov. I did remark to Matt, I hope Mazzetti just gets off the ground after victory a little bit quicker, because he did one of those sort of flat on the back celebrations and just left Dimitrov at the net for about 10 minutes, it felt like, before he eventually peeled himself off. But, you know, he's a kid and he just had the moment of his life. So, and Dimitrov's a lovely bloke, so it wasn't an issue. But yeah, if he carries on in the same way, he should have a lot to him. He seems to me to be standing very far back as his default position, which I personally liked it when he would step up a bit more. And I think the best players take advantage of players who are all the way back there.
I think closing out matches is something he will need to get a bit more efficient at. I think every win he had this week, it took him sort of several match points to just about get over the line. Yeah, I don't know. The reason the Gasquet comparison popped into my head was I was on YouTube and it recommended Gasquet versus Nadal at Monte Carlo in 2005. And I was watching that, and it was a really close match. Gasquet was, I think he won the first set against Nadal. And I thought to myself, was that Gasquet's biggest chance to win the French Open 2005? Possibly, because he was right there with Nadal, seemingly level-wise. And then Nadal just sort of went off into a different level that Gasquet could never reach and no one can reach at the French Open. But I just had this moment where I thought, was that kind of peak Gasquet in those very early years? And then I was trying to transfer those thoughts I was having about Mazzetti. I just think Mazzetti's future is so, so bright, surely.
That's a niche YouTube rabbit hole to fall down, Matt. We all have them.
Yeah.
So it was Tsitsipas that eventually toppled Mazzetti in the semi-finals. Fairly one-sided match. The eventual champion, Alex Zverev, had to topple Dominic Kupfer in the semi-finals. And they played through an earthquake. Yes, folks, you heard me right. An earthquake.
Yeah.
And it sort of didn't seem to notice. Certainly the commentators didn't notice. I suppose the commentators aren't there. And you might think maybe the cameraman is just, you know,
having a fiddling moment.
Fiddling with something in his pocket or something, I don't know. Because the carriage started shaking. But yeah, it was what else to say? It was an actual earthquake midpoint.
Yeah, Kupfer was on court when the sonic boom happened at the French Open. He was on court for the earthquake in Acapulco. And last year, I think in Rome as well, he was also on court for a blackout where they totally lost power midpoint. There's this brilliant video where they're just having a rally and the lights go out. And then you just gently hear in the umpire in the background going, "Let."
Is Kupfer playing Miami? I do hope so.
Yeah, I'm watching his matches in future.
Like a lightning rod for natural disaster. Not that a blackout's a natural disaster, but... right, well, it was Zverev that battled through the earthquake. Played Tsitsipas in the final. I watched the early stages of this live before going to sleep, and then I ended up watching the highlights. It looked like it was going to be a rout for Tsitsipas. I think he broke Zverev to love in Zverev's opening service game, during which there was an incredibly weird point where Zverev motioned to hit an overhead, what looked to be a fairly simple overhead from near the baseline, hit an air shot. It almost looked like a sort of Mansour Barami intentional moment, hit an air shot, and then turned on his heel and went back to the baseline to hit a standard forehand rally shot and dumped it into the net. It was extremely odd, and it was a moment that made me think, oh God, could this be like a proper rout where one party just doesn't show up and it's almost a bit awkward and uncomfortable? And it kind of proceeds that way for a while. Tsitsipas is just bullying him around and making him move, really making use of the drop shot, which is something he did against Mazzetti as well. It felt like he was just in a drop shot groove, and it was really working against Zverev because, you know, he's 6'6". Movement isn't the biggest part of his game. And then suddenly there's just this massive turnaround that I just didn't see coming. Not that I didn't see Zverev sort of rallying a bit, but I didn't see Tsitsipas squandering a 4-1 lead in the opening set. And it just felt like suddenly Zverev opened up his shoulders and started hitting really smoothly and just started absolutely middling the ball. And sometimes he can look a little bit like he's pushing it. The follow-through isn't quite there. Whereas when he's playing at his best, he's got that really kind of textbook scarf follow-through on the backhand side that I know Daniela and Greg are always talking about in the Prime Video Studio. The sort of the optimum double-handed backhand follow-through is where your two hands and your arms sort of form a scarf around your neck, and that's what it looked like he was doing on both wings as he sort of progressed through the match. But I'm still a bit perplexed about how that first set played out.
Well, Tsitsipas looked incredibly hot and bothered to me under those conditions, maybe not helped by the fact that he's wearing a black t-shirt that's just clinging to him, and he looked like he was a bit gassed in the points as well. I mean, there's some long points, he looked a bit out of breath. Zverev just seemed to go for it for quite a bit of the match, but I also think he was surprising Tsitsipas because occasionally there were these bullet serves and then there were these rolled in serves at 68 miles an hour. So I don't think Tsitsipas really knew what was coming from one point to the next. But it didn't seem as though it bothered Zverev. He wasn't getting worked up because he was double faulting or missing or anything. He just carried on. And I think he got the better of him in the end. And I think it was a 7-6 second set, which I didn't see personally. I didn't watch all of it, but it sounded pretty close, pretty on a knife edge until that tiebreak, and then he raced away with the tiebreak.
It was a really edgy end to the match. Zverev served for it at 6-4, 5-4, you know, did one of his absolutely terrible double faults into the bottom of the net. And then the next game, the 5-all game, he had 7 break points, couldn't take any of them. Tsitsipas saved them. And I was thinking at that point, well, it's quite likely now that Tsitsipas is going to, I don't know, take this second set and perhaps fall back into the pattern of that first set. But Zverev did manage to hold serve, take it into a tiebreak, and then played a really, really good tiebreak. Yeah, I agree. Tsitsipas did seem to be struggling a little bit in those conditions, but I think he really enjoyed Acapulco as a tournament. He's played Dubai in the past, but I have a feeling that he might now switch up that schedule and maybe go to Acapulco more often. He seemed to really embrace the atmosphere that there was, even with limited fans.
No one seems to go to Acapulco and go, that was crap.
Yeah.
Just doesn't happen, does it?
Yeah.
The difference was really jarring because Dubai obviously had no fans, and that it's a tough experience, I think, for these players. It's a tough watch in that way.
Yeah, and Tsitsipas was in pretty talkative mood after the match about various things. This is reported by Chris Otto on Twitter. There's some comments from Tsitsipas that kind of stirred a pot that's been on the hob for a little while in the old kitchen. I wasn't planning that analogy, but I do think it worked. he said, on the subject of heading into another bubble in Miami, he said, honestly, I like Miami as a tournament, but I feel I won't hide anything from you. I feel it won't be as good as the previous years, and I feel it won't be as good as Acapulco this week. I find it very difficult to believe. So I go there with low expectations, not expecting much from the tournament itself. It has other restrictions, and it will operate entirely on its own and with a different system. I like playing there, but without fans, it's going to be really different. And some other things that will be happening as well that I heard. I guess that also explains the absence of players. I don't want to say more and comment more on that, but in a way, I'm not surprised. So he takes the pin off the grenade and he tosses it into the ether. And that did pick up on a thread that had sort of been started by Denis Shapovalov earlier in the week. He had spoke to Reem Abalil in Dubai, and he said the following: I definitely think there's going to be a lot of withdrawals and a lot of people not going to tournaments because the prize money is low. In a way, it's not motivating to play every week and play all the big tournaments because there's not really a lot in it for us other than the slams at this point that are paying just as much or better, like in Australia this year. For sure, it's difficult for the players, but we're in this situation. Hopefully the ATP or someone can do something to improve the prize money and bring it back to what it was. But it is what it is right now. We have other obligations from sponsors, contracts that obligate us to play as well. So for sure, that's definitely one reason why a lot of players are still playing, because otherwise I feel like a lot of players just wouldn't play at all. I feel like other sports have been able to find solutions and find ways to keep the prize money and keep their salaries. I feel like there are better ways to solve this problem and go about it from the ATP side. And look, there are rumours swirling of some sort of action from the PTPA in Miami this week. Everybody's noticed how many withdrawals there have been on the ATP side. At the moment, it's only been individual withdrawals. There's been no group action or group statement or anything of that kind. We have asked around to see if anybody can sort of hint at anything official that might be in the works, and honestly, nobody's got anything. Sort of people are saying, yeah, I've heard the same as you, but nobody has much more than sort of it feels like something might be a brewing. Certainly nobody had my excellent kitchen analogy. I'm not saying there isn't reason for tennis players to be feeling it at the moment. There is. Just because they're millionaires and living a great life, they're still allowed to struggle with bubble life and struggle with not playing in front of crowds and struggle with all the various aspects of how the pandemic has compromised their existence. That's fine. Making comments about prize money and, surely the ATP can do something more or something different to preserve our prize money and incentivize us to play a bit more, and we wouldn't even bother playing if it weren't for sponsors. That's a different kettle of fish to me, and one that I just is going to fall so flat. If that's the premise on which some kind of group action is brewing, that is going to be a tough sell if they need to win hearts and minds. Maybe they don't. Maybe that doesn't matter to them. And I'm still yet to hear anybody say, this is how it is and it sucks, but here's exactly how we can do it differently and still have these tournaments offering brilliant prize money in the midst of this pandemic. How is that? Have you heard anybody make any suggestions on those lines? I haven't. I mean, it's rubbish. This pandemic is rubbish. It's rubbish for everyone. It is obviously completely unideal, the situation we have at the moment. But the show is on the road. And that is not an insignificant achievement. And it's one that we're all very grateful for. A lot of livelihoods depend on it. And the lack of appreciation for that is not going to play well, I don't think. It's hardly Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova talking about the obligation they felt like they had back in the day to the tour, to build the tour and support the tour and everything that that meant. Where's the obligation to something more than the individual?
Yeah.
We're not hearing it.
Yeah, I mean, I as you said, there are the bubble life itself is clearly tough, and there are players that have just decided to opt out because they don't want that to be their lives. Think back a year, and Ash Barty missed virtually the whole year, didn't she? Mm. And Nick Kyrgios is just not playing unless it's in Australia, and then Gilles Simon's pulled out of tennis now. I mean, he's at a certain age, I think, where he probably thinks it's maybe not so important. But yeah, it is a tough thing to listen to, really, to hear the 21-year-olds just talk about the prize money being a disincentive. Yes, I get it is. I get the point. But, I mean, do you want a tour or don't you, just at this stage? Because let's be realistic. They're all suffering. Now, you can argue about the degrees. John Isner has had his say on social media the other week, saying that he doesn't think that share is right between the players and the tournaments. I get it, but it just doesn't sit well with me, really. I'd rather they just got on with it for the most part at the moment.
Yeah, I think the only sort of alternative suggestion that I've heard was one that we talked about at the end of the Australian Open, which was players pushing to create a bubble for the tour to go to and stay at for a long time. It's just totally unrealistic in tennis. I think they were looking at the NBA bubble as the exemplar of that. But I believe that cost almost $200 million. It's just not possible for tennis, and with different tournaments that have their own gate and all that sort of thing, and how they create money.
What happens when tennis is able to resume as normal? The tournaments will have died.
Yeah,
you know, this is life support.
Yeah.
And tennis is far worse positioned than other sports due to its structure, its international nature, to cope with the pandemic. That is just an unfortunate fact about tennis. We'll see. We'll see. We'll be coming to you again on Thursday. If anything's happened, we'll update you on it. But yeah, as it stands at the moment, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, none of them are playing Miami. All different reasons.
Team.
Team not playing Miami. Yeah, I mean, it's a long old list.
But women's draw looks fantastic.
The Serena women's Williams draw is cracking. Aside. Serena is the only withdrawal from Miami, and that is disappointing. But it doesn't hit the draw that hard, I don't think. It doesn't feel like, oh, God. It feels like, that's a shame, but this is still cracking. And, you know, you've got Ash Barty there. This is her sort of re-entering the mainstream of playing tour tennis week in, week out, which is so welcome. The draw's been done. Barty's at the top of it as the top seed. She's got Kerber in her section. Azarenka and Kerber could play in round number three. Yes, please. You've got Simona Halep in the same section as Coco Gauff. I think they could play in round number three. You've got Petra Kvitova in there. Lina Svitolina, obviously. Those two are in the same section. Bianca Andreescu could play Amanda Anisimova in the third round. You've got Ons Jabeur Burr and Sophia Kenin could play in the third round. Karolina Pliskova and Jessica Pegula could play in the third round. Sakkari and Mertens, Mertens and Kontaveit, Osaka, Putintseva. I mean, those are opening round, like early round matches. I mean, it's just splendid. I'm going to marinate in all of it.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Also in the Miami draw, David, don't worry, we will talk about St. Petersburg. I'm leaving it to the end so that we can dedicate minimum possible time to it. But we're going to go to Monterey first. And a maiden WTA Tour title for 18-year-old Canadian Leila Fernandez. She beat Victoria Golubic in the final. Straight set. She didn't drop a set all week. She's a former French Open junior champion. 2019, she won that title. She was beaten by Clara Towson in the Australian Open girls' final that year. Ding, 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 Clara Towson alert. And she's potentially, I mean, she's got a long way to go, but she's a potential to add her name into the WTA Avengers, I think, in the coming years. And she'd be a welcome addition to the lineup if she does, because she's so different to the rest of them. She's this tiny little thing, which really, I mean, it's hard not to fall onto sort of pocket rocket style cliches, but she really is this tiny little thing. And she generates tremendous power relative to her size, but it's obviously not the power that, you know, an Osaka or an Andreescu have. But she just plays with this incredible precision, I think. So many of her balls drop sort of seemingly within 6 inches of the baseline, and she can play with tons of topspin, and she can also flatten it out. And because of her stature, her movement is just a dream. And I think the biggest weapon of all is the fire in her belly. She is, I don't know, she just looks like she's on a mission to me. There really seems to be a fire about her, and she lights up your screen, I think.
Yeah, we've seen it coming for a while in terms of her being a factor that you notice, a player that you notice, and yet this is the first time I think she's just blazed through a draw and had her way. had her way with everybody. She's been a really good opponent. She's had good wins, but this felt different. This felt like coming of age stuff. And she, you know, I reel off these players in the women's draws and just keep looking down them and thinking, crikey, this sport isn't a good place right now in women's tennis. But this is different. This is a player that wasn't in that list, really, for me. It was a player that they would come up against. Now she feels like maybe she could be one of them, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that analysis of her game. I love watching her play. She gets down so low. She really crouches. I mean, she can do that because she's slight, and yet she's got enough power. Extremely well balanced, really good IQ and court sense. It's a different style, yeah, but it's really watchable.
Something a little bit Hingis like about the way she moves the ball around and the way you can see her thinking several shots ahead.
Yeah, I think so. I think her serve is probably still it's improving, but the second serve is attackable. I think that's probably the one area where I look and think she could be vulnerable against players who are higher ranked than her.
And dare I draw a parallel there with the St. Petersburg champion Daria Kazatkina?
Yes, you may. Absolutely right. That's fine.
Off he goes.
Well, what's interesting about Kazatkina is she was the one we were talking about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
As being a really exciting talent. I remember us in the BT Sport studio when they had the rights just predicting when's this woman going to break the top 20. You know, it was that kind of conversation. And of course she did. And she reached the Indian Wells final. And I just find it a really interesting moment in the sport that she faced Osaka in the Indian Wells final 3 years ago and the directions the two of them went thereafter. Because really, Kazatkina has not improved since then. She hasn't gone up. Osaka's gone to the moon. But Kazatkina is so much fun to watch, such a joy when it's all going well, because she's this great athlete and ball player, not striker, a player, much more in the Barty mold. And I remember her playing later that year. She played Barty at Wimbledon, and I commentated on that match, and she dissected Barty and just dismantled her game, which is quite a thing to do. And unfortunately, it wasn't a game that has managed to move on. And I think we talked about it with Karatsev, having the right coach. She's coached now by Svetlana Kuznetsova's former coach. And there's a real similarity in the way those two play. Heavy, topspun forehand, variety, comfortable at the net, great mover. I mean, Kazatkina moves around the court like a butterfly. You don't hear her footsteps at all. And she came back in this St. Petersburg tournament from a set down 3 times, including twice from 1-6 down in, I think, the quarters and the semis to win through and fulfil exactly what I said would happen at the outset of the tournament.
Should say here that Matt also predicted Zverev would win in Acapulco.
Yeah, but
with dignity and grace.
But I got,
went through the whole discussion of that without mentioning it.
Yeah, but I got 3 times the points. So. Sign up to the newsletter, folks.
Talk us through the victory ceremony, David. Well, we love a St. Petersburg victory ceremony. Margarita Gasparian does not.
No. Well, I can't give you chapter and verse, because I can tell you that at match point I sort of started doing my own cartwheels around the living room, having won the newsletter predictions tournament for the week and closed the gap on Matt to 20 points. And then 38 minutes later, having left the match, I turned it back. I turned the stream back on because it was still live and I couldn't understand why it was still live. And there's Margarita Gasparian, who, poor player, had retired injured 40 minutes earlier. And there she was just about to give her runner-up speech on the court, having sat through, well, what looked like a magnificent show, but I'm not sure that's exactly what she wanted to be exposed to at that particular point.
Yes. Did you sit through all of it, Matt?
Do you know, this is one of the first occasions I've not watched the St. Petersburg ceremony. I normally mark my calendar, you know, for the WTA one and the ATP one at the end of the year. It's a real event. But no, I did miss this one.
They usually get a sort of B-rate singer from the 90s to perform. And it's great.
It'd be fascinating if Kasatkina can build on this. I mean, she's won two titles now this year. She won... I'm into territory of a title in Australia that whose name I can't remember. I think it might have been the one in the second week of the Australian Open.
The Penguin one.
The Penguin one. She won that one.
Phillip Island Trophy.
Phillip Island, yeah. That's it. So she's got two titles now, and let's hope she can, because that slump she went through after that rise that David has described, to me, is one of the most inexplicable ones, because I think, I don't know, sometimes we look for things to be black and white, and there was no injury you could point to. There was no big moment where you thought, oh, everything's just gone wrong for Kasatkina. She just seemed to lose form. And it also happened at a time where, I don't know if this sounds harsh, but I'm not sure people were really talking about the fact that she'd lost form that much. It was noted, but there was so much else going on. There were so many new players coming through. All the ones we talk about now had kind of had their breakthrough in 2019. Barty, Świątek, Wondroszewa reached the French Open final. There was a lot more going on. And I think Kasatkina kind of drifted. And I think people might have thought, oh, well, we don't necessarily need Kasatkina to be part of the picture. But it's a more interesting picture if she is in it, because she has got an interesting game. Really sort of exuberant off the court, varied tennis, as David has described. And she's spoken about using a sports psychologist to really get her back on the right road. She's been quite open about that. And I think it's a game that can add a lot to an already interesting tour. So let's hope she can build on this.
She's going to be an interesting case study, definitely. I mentioned Cabal and Farah winning the doubles title in Dubai earlier. We've had some other interesting doubles results from the week, David. What have we got?
Well, I think the most notable ones are the Skupski brothers, Ken and Neil, from Liverpool in the UK, who played doubles together for a number of years, obviously being brothers, and then separated when... Jamie Murray and Neil Skupski started playing together and had some success. And then that split when Jamie wanted to go and play with Bruno Suarez. And it's quite interesting hearing Neil say that with his higher ranking, I mean, in theory, he could have gone and played with somebody else ranked 20 or 30 in the world, but he only wanted to play with his brother again. He did not want to play with anybody else. And even Ken was trying to convince him that he probably should play with one of these higher ranked players. And there they were in Acapulco, blazing their way through this draw, beating Murray and Suarez, which is, you know, quite a statement in itself. Then they beat Joe Salisbury and Rajiv Ram. So they've basically beaten two of the best British doubles players. And there's a lot of them. We'll concentrate on that in weeks to come, because it's just been such an incredible run that British doubles has had recently. And then they managed to win the final as well. And the look on their faces, I mean, Catherine, you would just have melted.
I did. I've watched the victory moment.
Oh,
yeah.
It's great win for them. And they're really nice blokes. I'm really chuffed for them.
Just an addendum to that, it's going to, if assuming the Olympics goes ahead and everything suggests that it will, British doubles picks at the Olympics, or not picks, but who plays for GB in the doubles, is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure is. And then in St. Petersburg, it was Kitchenik and Olaru who won the doubles. And in Monterey, it was Asia Mohammed and Caroline Dolhide beating Heather Watson and Zheng Sai Sai. So that's your doubles roundup.
A doubles whip round. I mentioned earlier that I'd done the Andy Murray interview. It's run on Prime Video. I'm sure it'll run again this week. You two both watched it. This isn't a Catherine Fisher's for compliments section of the podcast again. We've already done that. But what about what that Andy Murray said in that interview jumped out to you two? If anything.
Well, I mean, lots. It was really good. And his openness, his ambition, his dedication to get back, and belief that he can, and his observation to you asked him if the game had moved on in the years since he was world number one, and he said no. Not really.
Well, another crap impersonation. Great. Thanks for joining me there, David.
Keep your company. And he clearly thinks, and he was categoric about it, that he thinks, and he's looking forward to being part of a Wimbledon draw that he thinks he can be successful in and win the title in. He genuinely believes, he said, that is a possibility. I might be delusional, some people might think, but I believe that is possible.
Yeah, I also found that comment about the game not moving on to be fascinating. I've thought about it a lot. And the way you put it to him, Catherine, was the last time you were competing at the top to now, how would you compare it? So we're talking about sort of the middle of 2017, really. And I mean, my interpretation of Murray's comment there is he believes that if he can get back to the level he was at, he will still be able to win, for example, Wimbledon, as he's laid out there. Because I do think a lot of the game has moved on. I must say, I think mainly I'm talking about the contenders to the big three, I think, have come on. I mean, 4 years ago, we were talking about Raonic, Nishikori, Goffin and Dimitrov, basically. Now we're talking about Team, Medvedev, Tsitsipas and Zverev. And I would say this current group is stronger. I think I think the big three have got bigger obstacles now than they had in 2017, for example.
Dropped Nishikori like a hot potato, Matt.
But I agree with Murray as well that if he can get back to that level, I don't think the game has moved on from the very top. I think if he can find his top level, he will be back in amongst it. But the question is, can he? But I love the fact that he truly believes that he can and is going to give everything to find out.
Yeah, look, there are people out there that does think he's delusional, but why wouldn't he try? Why would if it's possible, even in, you know, a highly unlikely alternate universe, even if it's a 0.01% opportunity, why wouldn't you try? I think it's inspiring, and it's going to be very interesting to see him in Miami because he's got every chance of a decent draw because it is such a decimated draw, and he likes it there. He traditionally has played some of his very best tennis in Miami. He likes the conditions, so that's one to watch, certainly. We'll be back on Thursday with another podcast reviewing the first few days of Miami. We'll, of course, as we come to you at the moment, we don't have the men's draw. So, we'll be able to bring you more Miami news and results and some stuff that'll probably be out of date by the time that you listen, which I know is what you come to the tennis podcast for. Our mascot for Thursday and for today is Saunders, and I really feel like you're having a laugh with me here, given how the last podcast ended. Saunders the rabbit. Saunders' owner is Chris. Chris is celebrating his birthday on Tuesday. So happy birthday, Chris. And please enjoy Saunders being the sponsor of the podcast, a podcast that loves rabbits very much. My mascot is Zeus. Really going to try and go for glory this week, Zeus. David's is Rogue.
Yeah,
we've
Rogue.
Had enough gloating.
Me and you, Rogue. We nailed it.
Yep, there it is again. Scousal Mousal, Matt, shares victory with you for the week.
Yes. Yes, we also nailed it.
Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer. Hello, Chris. You're a top bloke. And our shout outs are for
Jenny Price.
Hi, Jenny.
Hello, Jenny.
Thanks a lot.
Like Jenny Brady. That's what we're calling her now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
Kate Bradley.
All right, Kate.
Hello, Kate. I could have been a Kate, but my parents went for Kathy.
Yeah, with an IE.
No. Oh, Moving on. Hello, Kate. Thanks for your support.
And finally, Morag, who we know.
Oh, we know Morag. Hello.
Morag's lovely and always backs us. Thanks ever so much, Morag.
I don't know any other Morags.
No, me neither.
I don't want to know any more.
Morag, you're the only Morag we know.
Correct.
You're great. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends, only if they like tennis. If they don't like tennis, it's probably not the one for them. But do let them know if they've got a mere passing interest in tennis. Tune in to Prime Video to watch the Miami Open from Wednesday. Do subscribe to our newsletter. It's great. It really is great. I'm not just saying that because David tells me to say it. It is excellent. I look forward to it in my inbox every week. And join us again for another tennis podcast on Thursday. We'll speak to you then.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.